I serve the village's education coordinator, and it's my pleasure to introduce our panel for Interfaith Dialogue Week, co-sponsored by Tracy Levine Center. Again, thank you, Terry, for that. Welcome, Iman, Adam, Jamal. Thank you, Adam, for your session last night and your words of vespers. Very much appreciated. Rabbi Johanna Kinberg and Pastor Terry Kyle. We look forward to this discussion this morning, tomorrow afternoon, and Thursday morning at the same time. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Sharon. And thanks to everybody for coming this morning. We're so glad you're here. I'm trying to find a presentation remote, which I seem to have lost, but maybe that's just the way it's going to go. So we're really thankful that y'all are here to join us for this conversation, to learn with us together here. The three sessions we have are organized really around three questions. The three questions that, you know, I sort of think are forming the basis of the challenges of the human species at this point. What gives life meaning? How will we live with each other given our cultural differences? And how will we live as a part of the Earth's ecosystem while respecting it and future generations? So there's a lot of anxiety out there in the human species about these deep questions and others. And Johanna, Adam, and I are going to answer them definitively for all time. And that is not the case. Yes. So we're going to try to suggest some beginning points and map out some first thoughts about that with you. So the way our sessions will go, excuse me, sorry, I got it now. Here's the three challenges, and then the way our sessions are going to go is this. We're going to be doing a brief introduction to the challenge that we're going to be talking about today. We're going to give you a few minutes to sort of sit and think about your reaction to the question and to the setup for it. And just, you know, sit and notice especially your emotions about it as we bring this issue up. And then we'll have a 15-minute introduction from each faith leader. I'll be going first today. And then there'll be a time for us to respond to each other about what we learned and heard and appreciated about each other's time and comments. And then in groups of three, we'll be encouraging you to do some conversation about what you heard and to kind of form a question in groups of threes. Right, so kind of, you know, bring your best questions and kind of figure out how you're gonna ask some of those questions, and then we'll have some time to respond. So Johanna's gonna do the first kind of setup here for what gives life meaning.
We call ourselves Homo sapiens, wise people. We certainly need wisdom. It's not enough for us just to have food, clothing, and shelter. Humans require the sustenance of a reason to live, and a story that explains who we are and what gives our lives significance. The problem is that humans can gain sustenance from stories that do not work for the thriving of the earth, of others, and even those who live within that story. Our need for meaning may be hardwired, but the software that provides the meaning can be bad for the hardware. Many have noted that, at least in Europe and the United States, that we now live in an increasingly secular age, an age focused on the imminent world, so that to avoid any meaning beyond the plain state of things in the here and now. Some claim that their meaning story is the only true story, and that other meaning stories are false. Some claim that since no story is ultimate, that all meaning stories are irrelevant, and that all meaning stories are fake news. Others claim that our meaning stories point to a larger, deeper, and mysterious truth, and so we are free to learn from and with others. Thomas Merton put it well. Today, everything is in question. Monasticism, Christianity, reason, all values, humanity itself. Hence, it's no longer easy for a person to discover his identity by choosing and embracing certain well-established tradition standards, which no one doubts, and simply experience these as his own. To choose a value that is questioned and doubted is to place oneself in the position of being doubted. The mature person is able to assume this risk. He can embrace an unpopular idea, commit himself to it and to its consequences, and accept the fact that it means becoming a problem, and even in some ways, a scandal to others. It is in this way that most people today have to establish and affirm their identity. But it takes courage to do this. Hence, all values are questioned or can be. To embrace any of them is to become an object of questioning and doubt. Those who shirk from personal responsibility shrink from this also. They seek to rest on an ineffable authority or else take refuge in an area where questions are not asked. What does the Abrahamic tradition have to offer?
So give yourself a minute or two to sort of think and feel about this, especially noticing your feelings. So when I was in college, I was told a story about how human civilization, as we call it, got started. And that story was pretty simple. People learned how to farm. And they learned how to farm, and then they had to stay around to, you know, like weed things and keep things watered and protected. And so they began to form little villages. And that's how civilization started. It was because of a technological kind of novelty and discovery. But there's some evidence out there that human beings did not start necessarily to gather into larger communities just simply because of farming. Because human beings don't live by bread alone, right? So there is some evidence out there that human beings began to form communities because they realized the power of shared meaning. And we know this just from simple experience. Like if you go to a great concert with, say, you know, U2 or Coldplay or something like that up there, whatever band you love, and imagine you're the only person that shows up. Is that concert as great as if there's 10 or 20 or 30,000 people there? And so I'm not going to go into all the archaeology around that. I'm just going to say that human beings seem to have experienced the power of collective meaning at some point in our not-so-distant past, and then farming sort of came alongside as a way to support that. And why is that? And that's because human beings don't live by bread alone. We need a sense of meaning. And I would argue that we need a sense of meaning because we're mortal, and we're limited, and we know that we're going to die. And so we want to know, like, what our life means, like, what makes the pain and the anxiety and also the beauty and joy of being human worth it. Like, we want to know that. And human beings began to realize somehow that in the midst of their community, they could find a power to, like, lean into and relax into a sense of shared meaning. And so human beings, we live by meaning, we live by community, and we live by hope. The problem is that as these civilizations began, the people who shaped the stories were able to take advantage of a lot of other people who were listening to the story. And we've discovered, I think, right now in our larger, like, you know, American and European cultures, that there's a problem with shared story. With shared meaning, that we can derive collective meaning from stories that don't work for human beings and for the planet. We can fall short of the aspirations of our shared meaning, and that we can claim stories that are them. We can claim that the stories themselves are ultimate, and in the Abrahamic tradition, of course, we call that idolatry, right, when we do that. So the Abrahamic tradition, I would argue, began as both a critique of meaning systems gone awry, and the Abrahamic tradition proposes another way to live. So we find this out in Genesis chapter 12, where I'm going to use Abraham and Sarah's name in their later form. So Abraham and Sarah are invited to leave their home and their family. And because God wants to make them a blessing to all the nations of the world. And that seems to imply in those very short verses that they were not able to be a part of a larger culture that was a blessing to all the nations of the world where they were living. And in fact, archaeology has shown us that that the city of Ur, where they were from, the king and queen, when they were buried with lots of gold and other kinds of valuable artifacts, and were in fact buried with artisans who were apparently killed to join the king and queen to help build their palace in the afterlife. So the story, the shared story that was happening there was perhaps being used to advantage some people and to disadvantage some others. And so Abraham and Sarah are invited to go and to form another kind of community that would be a blessing not only to themselves but to all the families of the world, because that's what God's up to. That's what God's all about, is blessing all the families of the world. And so we see through the Abrahamic tradition, and I'm going to focus on the Jesus part, the Abrahamic tradition leaders standing up and being called to help draw us back to that initial vision that God has for how to create a blessing for all the people of the world. Moses was invited by God to help free slaves from Egypt, where the gods and city hall had conspired to make slavery inevitable and divinely ordained. The prophets of the people of Israel, out of a faithful self-critique, called the people of Israel to change when they fell short of God's vision. In Babylon, a storyteller, hearing the Babylonian creation story that humans are made to be slaves, and that's just the way it is, wrote the first story of creation, saying that human beings are made in the image of God, and we are part of a good and very good creation. So in the Abrahamic tradition, in the way theologians have been talking about this, that the critique was that human beings and human societies often form domination systems. The domination system is a system in which what it means to be human is to have power over other people. And if you can't have power over other people directly, then you become part of a civilization or part of a nation state or part of a gang or whatever it is to have power over others collectively. So you may not have power directly. You may be in a pecking order and maybe even kind of low on it, but you at least have some power collectively, right? And so the Abrahamic tradition proposes, I think, that is in fact not blessing. that is not what God intends. That the storytellers have created a maladaptive story that's going to hurt the human beings in that culture and hurt human beings who are considered outside of it. So I would say that the Abrahamic tradition, again, in the way that Christian theologians have been talking about this for some time now, proposes another kind of meaning system, and that is a meaning system of mutuality. That what it means to be human is to have power with other people, holding our needs and others' needs and the needs of creation in tension with each other. That's the kind of meaning system that the Abrahamic tradition is trying to uphold, right? In the midst of societies where that's not the dominant story. And so let's just talk about Jesus just for a minute. Jesus began his story within a domination system imposed by the Roman Empire and raised upon the stories of his own people, sitting on his Jewish mother's knee and learning the stories from her, going to the synagogue in Nazareth, he heard a different story than the one the Roman Empire was selling, which is that you can be great when the Roman Empire captures another city somewhere else. And so what God is trying to do through Jesus, as I understand it as a Christian, is to break this domination system and the power of this domination system over people and to create what Jesus called the kingdom of God. I know the word kingdom is a problematic word, right? But what I think he's trying to get at is a mutuality culture. And so what is a mutuality culture? Well, it's quite simply living out God's love and grace and shalom in every aspect of human existence, public, private, economic, political, personal, communal. It includes our body, our mind, and the larger environment. And that Jesus is proposing to his own folk that they don't have to live by the rules of the domination system anymore. They don't have to accept the meaning system that's being given to them by the Romans. That they can begin to live a different way because God is bringing this mutuality culture because it is near. And Jesus is saying to them that we don't have to live this way. So Jesus begins his ministry after his baptism by John in the River Jordan. And he goes out immediately, says the Gospels, to spend 40 days in the wilderness to begin to wrestle with the way the domination system has wormed its way into him. Just as the people of Israel spent some time, 40 years in the wilderness, to help unlearn the patterns of the Egyptian domination system. A man once, in an NPR story, had been wrongfully imprisoned for like 25 years. And he was finally released, and his son takes him to coffee and breakfast every Saturday morning. And every Saturday morning for years, the man had to cautiously and quietly ask his son, "Can I have a second cup of coffee?" Because in prison they only had one. So Jesus is spending 40 days in the wilderness out there fasting to begin to help maybe himself recognize the power of this larger system on him. And he's presented with three temptations. He's presented with three temptations: to make bread from the stones, to cast himself off from the temple so the angels can catch him in front of everybody. Kind of a religious first century David Copperfield sort of thing. And then to accept control over the nations of the world. And the devil here is not like just some dude in a red suit with a pointy tail. The devil here really is the voice of empire and its meaning system calling to us. So Jesus' temptations are not simply his temptations. There are temptations that we experience all the time. To put our individual life and comfort in front of God and all of our neighbors, right? To seek status over other people by, you know, being powerful and showing off all of our awesome capacities, and to accept control over the nations of the world. In other words, to try to win the game that the Romans are playing. To succeed by the rules of a domination culture. But Jesus doesn't want to win the game. God is not calling him to win the game. God is calling him to change the game. And so what Jesus does throughout his ministry is to try to reorient people from a vision of power over others and domination and bullying and the Roman Empire mafia system with the standing army, to begin to live in a more circular way, to begin to live God's way of mutuality. And that Jesus did this because, not because his ideas were novel. And this is the part that's sometimes hard, I think, for Christians. but that Jesus is leading as a faithful member and leader within the Abrahamic tradition. Because the Abrahamic tradition was itself a critique of domination systems and was itself a critique, offered an alternative view for how human beings can live on this planet. So I must say that being oriented to God's reign is neither assured by calling ourselves Christians, or calling myself a Christian, nor is it exclusive to faithful Christians. In fact, I would say that every day I am being reoriented, as I understand it in my baptism, to move away from a power over other people kind of meaning system to a power with other people meaning system. And now, when I say this sort of thing, of course, people say, oh, well, the human beings have always been organized in domination systems, and you're just like dreaming of like some kind of like fantasy Disneyland thing, and so why don't you just go hang out there with Tinkerbell, right? People sort of say that to me. But in the New Testament, in the Christian scriptures, and in the Hebrew scripture, which is also a key part of the Christian tradition, Paul says in Hebrews, the writer says in Hebrews, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. The thing hoped for is not, in my view, some kind of life after death scenario up in heaven, although I think God offers that. The thing not seen is a world in which human beings can live with each other, in where my needs are in tension with everyone else's needs, and our collective needs as human beings are held in tension with the creations. But I would say that today, as I near wrap up here, that we are being again, and perhaps perennially, tempted by the agent of empire to put our individual comfort before God and our neighbors and the creation. That we're being tempted to seek status over others and to play by the rules of empire and win at it with our faith traditions sort of buffering and softening it just a little bit. And so the question, you know, for me, as I think about what it means to be human, how do we understand this, is that Jesus, Moses, and Muhammad are part of an Abrahamic tradition, which, again, proposes a critique of domination systems and proposes another way to live, finding meaning and power with others in living in God's way of mutuality, finding meaning and power with others in participating with God in the healing and creation of the world, as Douglas John Hall has said. So that's my little 15 minutes. Who wants to go next?
So I actually have a handout if someone wants to grab those. There's about 30 of them, so you can share. So where I wanted to start today in beginning to address this question, and I want to just say that this is a Jewish response, not the Jewish response. It's a response that comes from me and my unique worldview and experiences towards you, but it's rooted in text and tradition. So I wanted to take you along a text journey with me as to where I'm going with these thoughts, and I'm starting with Albert Einstein and not with the Torah. So the first text I want to start with is Einstein. And why Einstein? Well, Einstein, like myself, grew up in a Jewish world. He had a probably much better and more thorough Jewish education than I did. His whole world was Jewish, and throughout his career, he was never able to get a job until he came to this country, except for a low-level job in a patent office, because he was a Jew. So no matter how brilliant he was, his career was thwarted in Europe, because much of the European Jewish experience has been one of power and subjugation. So he grew up a second-class citizen and moved to the United States to escape the Holocaust. And his expression of spirituality and relationship to what he wouldn't call the divine, but I do, for me, is an expression of Jewish survival and the message that we bring through our survival for thousands of years as to what does it matter to be here on this planet today? So Einstein wrote, a human being is part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. I love that line. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but striving for such achievement is, in itself, a part of the liberation and the foundation for inner security. So when I read this Einstein text, I can point out, like, oh, this is where he gets this in the Jewish tradition. This is the text that influenced this line. But if you look right above it, the passage from Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, this passage is the core and central prayer for the Jewish people. It's what we say when we pray three times a day. It's in the mezuzah, the little piece, ritual object that's on the doorpost of Jewish homes. This is the text that's inside of it. It's what we say when we get up in the morning, when we go to sleep at night, and it's also supposed to be the last things you say, last words on your lips before death. And after the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 72 of the Common Era, the way that Israelites, soon to become Jews, practiced their religion was through the temple, through animal sacrifice, through the ritual of the priests, what we call the Israelite cult system. When the temple was destroyed for the second time by the Romans, it's like, okay, well, what do we do next? How do you continue to move on as a people without this institution of the priests and the sacrifices? And there's a story that Rabbi Judah the Prince stood on the rubble of the Second Temple with his students around him, so he would have been a first century rabbi, and they said, what do we do? And he said, our world now stands on a three-legged stool. And of course, with three-legged stool, you need all three for it to be balanced. Our world is now based on Torah, the five books of Moses, and he also meant the whole canon of the Jewish people. Avodah, which used to mean ritual sacrifice, but now means prayer. So that's why we pray three times a day to match the sacrificial system that happened three times a day at the temple. And third, Gemilut Chasadim, acts of love and kindness. So those are the three pillars of what became Judaism, rabbinic Judaism. That's the world that Buber grew up in. It's the world I grew up in. It's the world that the Baal Shem Tov grew up in. And at the core of that, decisions were made about what would be taken from the sacred text that would be our prayers. And this is the core text that was selected, the Shema and Ve'ahavta. So I'm just going to chant a little bit of it in Hebrew to you and then read it in the English to give you a sense. But this is what it sounds like in the Hebrew. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, V'chol levavcha, V'chol nafshecha, U'v'chol me'odecha. V'hayu hadvarim ha'ele, asha nohi mitzavecha, hayom alevavecha, vishinantam levanecha, vidibarta ba'am, v'shivtecha b'veitecha u'vlechtecha ha'vaterech, u'shokvecha kumecha. I could go on almost to the end, but I just want to give you a sense of what it sounds like in the Hebrew when we chant it in our prayers. And is here, O Israel, the Lord, or the Eternal, or Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton, is our God. The Eternal God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, is one, is unity, is unification. And then it goes on to say that you shall love God with your heart, your might, your strength. Christians, you're probably very familiar with this passage. It's also part of your textual tradition, and it's about walking the path, the derech. This is how you actually walk the way of being living in harmony with the divine. So this is our central prayer, and it leads us to unity and unification and walking a righteous path. And that is hard in a world that feels so dark and fractured at some times. Since the destruction of the Second Temple, The Jewish people, up until 1948, considered themselves exiles, living in galut, living outside of the place that's comfortable, that's peace, that's harmony. Often in our society today, sometimes we feel like we're living in exile. Where are we? What is this place? Am I in exile? So this draw towards unification, towards breaking down boundaries, is a very powerful force because it helps us have a vision for what's possible in this world. If you look at our next text in the upper right-hand corner, during the darkness of our European history arose a wonderful thinker named the Baal Shem Tov to bring back to the Jewish imagination this notion of joy and what I call self-healing. And he writes, "Bear in mind regarding the Creator that the whole earth is full of his glory, and his Shekhinah," that's God's divine feminine presence, "is constantly at your side. Always be joyful. Think and believe with perfect faith that the Shekhinah is at your side and watches over you. You look at the Creator, blessed be he, and the Creator, blessed be he, looks at you." The Baal Shem Tov, and you know, during this time period, if you look at the dates, railed against what he saw as a pervasive depression amongst the Jewish people, that living in subjugation for so long created a sadness and a rigidity. And so what he wanted the Jewish people to do was to learn through this concept of unification and cleaving to God that we can actually heal ourselves, that we've been made to be self-healing creatures. And that's why I believe that Jews have always been so drawn towards psychology and psychiatry, is because this idea that through human wisdom and knowledge, through science and through observation, that we can actually heal ourselves from the trauma that we now know about with epigenetic trauma can go from generation to generation. So this idea of unification also teaches us that we can, through our interactions with each other, heal ourselves and heal humanity. And so I wanted to share with you last this prayer, preparing yourself for prayer as an example of Jewish practice in the consciousness of unification. "I now prepare to unify my whole self, heart, mind, consciousness, body, passions, with this holy community, with the Jewish people everywhere, with all people everywhere, with all life and being. To commune with the source of all being, may I find the words, the music, the movements that will put me in touch with the great light of God. May the beauty of God rest upon us, and may God establish the works of our hands, and may the works of our hands establish God." And it's that mutuality, that God may establish the works of our hands, and that we establish God through the works of our hands, through breaking down the barriers, through this delusion of separateness.
That was awesome.
And there's a story for you on the back that was just a very, very important and moving spiritual story within my own life that I just wanted to share with you by Martin Buber.
Brother Adam.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
I don't know how to follow up all of that. I'll try my best to talk about the topic, which is what gives life meaning, from the perspective of my faith. So in the Quran, which is the holy book of Muslims, there's a verse where God says, the original Arabic is, "وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ," that I created mankind only for my worship. Now, that tells us what our purpose is. Our purpose is to worship him. And the question that comes thereafter is, well, why does God need me to worship him? Right? Well, how does that benefit him? This question actually, it assumes a few things, and so I want to break it down a little bit. The first thing is that God is not like human beings. He does not have the kinds of needs that we have. In our faith, we believe that God does not sleep, that he does not tire, that he does not need food, he does not need sustenance, that he is needless. So why does he ask us to worship him? The best example that I can think of is when a doctor asks a patient to open their mouth. Is the doctor asking the patient to open, you know, is the doctor saying open wide, is he saying that, or is she saying that in order to benefit herself? No. She's saying it in order to benefit the patient. And so that is the idea behind God creating us for worship. That he has created us in a way that we require this worship in order to sustain ourselves. And it reminds me of what Pastor Marcus was saying on Sunday with bread and this, the symbolism of bread within the Christian faith, that you nurture, you nourish yourself through the consumption of bread, and you also nurture yourself through the consumption of spirituality in the consumption of your faith and in acting on the tenets of your faith. So we don't worship God for him. Rather, we worship God for ourselves. And the reality is that we are spiritual beings imprisoned in this physical body. That is what my faith teaches me, that we were not meant for this world, that we were created for this other world, this spiritual world, but we were placed on this world to test us, and that we are given these physical bodies as a responsibility, and we are given this earth as a responsibility for us to take care of and for us to make the most of. Then the second question that comes, the first question was, well, why does God need us to worship him? And as I said, that God doesn't need us to worship him, and rather we need to worship God, because we are spiritual beings. The second question, what does worship actually mean? What does it mean to worship God? Is it simply the prayers that we make? Is it simply the rituals that we do, the services that we attend? Or is it something more than that? And in our faith, worship is actually, it transcends simply ritualistic worship. Although ritualistic worship is a very important and integral part of our faith, we also believe that it transcends that. So to give you an example, during the life of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, may the peace and blessings of God be upon him, during his life, one of the things he used to encourage people to do was to take care of the poor and the orphans. And that giving charity raised one's ranks with God and raised oneself with God. And so he used to encourage people to give charity. Now a bunch of poor people came to him and they said, well, we have a problem. We don't have any money. So how can we participate in this act? How can we participate in charity? Because we don't actually have any money. So how are we going to participate? The rich, they are giving their wealth and they're getting these blessings and they're getting these ranks with God. And we're not able to do that same thing because we just don't have the money for it. So what should we do? And that is when Muhammad, he explained that charity is more than simply giving money. It is more than that. He said, smiling at someone is an act of charity. He said that if there is something, a disturbance on the road that's going to disturb people, then to remove that disturbance is an act of charity. Spending your day with your spouse is an act of charity. Remembering God and praising him is an act of charity. And so all of these things are acts of charity, and they all are considered worship. And even many scholars, they talked about, Muslim scholars, they talked about, for example, consuming food. If someone consumes food with the intention that they are going to be strengthened and they are going to then act out the commands of God and they are going to pursue justice and pursue truth in this world, that even consuming food can then become an act of worship. In the same way, if someone has the intention of sleeping in order to become strengthened, in order to do that same worship, then that sleeping in those 8 hours also counts as 8 hours of worship. And that means that a lot of us do a whole lot of worship, especially when we're in Holland Village. My son, he's two, he does 12 hours of worship. So that's the essence of worship. And then coming back to the reality of the world today, if we look at America today, I think it was two months ago, when one very famous person, Anthony Bourdain, committed suicide, right? And that was such a sad moment. Someone who had, you would say materially, he had a whole lot. And I don't know if I would say everything, but he had a whole lot. Things that most people dream of, things that most people spend their entire lives trying to attain in terms of material wealth and respect and fame and a job where he just goes around and travels and talks to people and meets different kinds of people. But I guess it's hard to put it into words, but he wasn't full, he wasn't complete. And many people feel this way today. And if people have those kinds of thoughts, you have to go and you have to see a professional about that. And my hearts go out to people that are suffering from that. But we've seen this time and time again where people who have the world, they have everything, they have all the material, they're not complete. And for many of us, we engage in the pursuit of material or empire, as Pastor Terry was mentioning. And maybe we should keep in mind that once we achieve that empire and achieve all of that material, we won't be complete because we aren't material beings. We are also the spiritual beings. We also are this consciousness, this spiritual consciousness, and we have to feed that spirituality. We have to feed that spiritual part of ourselves. I'm not saying that spirituality would cure depression and would cure suicide and things like that, but I'm saying there is a bit of a correlation, because since 1999, here in the United States of America, suicide rates have increased by 30%. And religiosity has also declined by just as much. And so there is some correlation there. Faith is well studied to give people the strength that they need to go about their lives. The CDC actually released a report around the same time, around 2 months ago, that said that it's not just depression that is leading to suicide, but it is the lack of meaning in people's lives. It is the lack of people having this purpose. People aren't able to deal with the certain unfortunate realities of modern life, whether it is their relationships with others. Another thing that has increased since 1999, in the past 20 years, is loneliness. Americans are more lonely than ever. And so, what is one solution to this? One solution to this is finding our purpose and using our faith to find that purpose and that greater purpose that leads us not only to God, but to those around us, so that we can not only engage with God, but we also engage in community with our fellow human beings. And to realize that devoting ourselves only to the material, it will not ever complete us. I like to use, when I talk to youth about these topics, I like to use the example of video games. I remember that when I would see my friend who got this new video game, it was called Halo on Xbox. If anyone knows it. And I was like, man, this game's so amazing. I want an Xbox, I want Halo. Begged my mom, begged my dad. We finally got it. I got Halo. I played it for a day. And then that was it. And then I was on the shelf. And it's like, oh, that's just the game. I kind of got enough out of it. And let's move on to the next thing. And that's what it is. We chase the material goods, and then we get them, and then we're like, oh, that's it. And then now we want the next thing, right? Immediately. So let's not devote all our lives to the material. That's not to say we can't have those things, but let's also realize that we have another purpose on this earth. And I'll end with a prayer that the Prophet Muhammad taught us that he used to make this prayer, and it's a very important prayer in our faith. He said, "O God, you are my Lord. None has the right to be worshipped except you. You created me and I am your servant, and I abide by your covenant and promise as best as I can. I take refuge in you from the evil which I have committed. I acknowledge your favor upon me, and I acknowledge my sin. So forgive me, for certainly none can forgive sin except you." And so that prayer is an acknowledgement of God's favor, and it is an acknowledgement that God is the one that will judge us, and he is the one who holds our purpose. So thank you very much, and thank you.
That's great. Thank you. So now we'll if we feel like it, let's take a few minutes and just share anything that we might have appreciated about the others' perspectives, or even point out areas where it seemed different and yet the same. So anybody want to start first?
I kind of alluded to what you said about empire in my talk. Actually, I just spoke, so I'm going to let you guys go first. That's okay. And then I'll say something.
Okay, that's fine. Johanna, do you want to go first?
I think one of the things that all of us touched on is the notion of power and how it's used in the world and who we give power to and how to appropriately ascribe power. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I heard that too, and I also heard all three of us talk about the relationship of the individual to the community, to the earth, and that there was a sense I think right now in the United States, especially, and this is where I live, I see a lot of people operating as if the individual human being is the only unit of humanity that matters. And all of our traditions are trying to say, no, not quite. that we are individuals who are important and beloved of God and who have meaning just because of our existence and because God's gift of existence. But we also have responsibility to and meaning with others and with community. And I also appreciated how both of you brought up the notion of healing. Which I think was sort of in mind, but I didn't bring it up immediately, directly. But I really appreciated Johanna, like that just that beautiful sense that that there is a strive for unity, which acknowledges the disunity that we currently experience. And I appreciated that. And Adam, I really appreciated the description of what worship is. And that's very similar, I think, to what Christian worship is at its best. But again, we also, our community sometimes has members who believe that worship is what happens between 10 and 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Right, when that is in fact not really what it says. So.
I'm reminded of people that are in the hospital, and if they get visitors, the rate of their healing goes up. So being in the community and being a part of a community and that actually can heal you. One of the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad was that the rights the rights that you owe to your brother and sister in humanity, among them is for you to visit him or her when they're sick. That's a right they have upon you. And so that's something that's really emphasized in our faith. One of the closest people to Muhammad was a man called Abu Bakr. And Abu Bakr, one day, Muhammad, he asked his companions, he said, who of you has fasted today? And a few people raised their hands, who fasted today. then he asked, who of you has visited a cemetery today? And a few people raised their hands. And he said, in addition to that, who of you has fed the poor today? And a few hands went down. And then he said, which of you has visited a sick person today? And a few hands went down. And the only hand remaining was Abu Bakr, because he had done all four of those things in a single day, on a random day, that when Muhammad was asking about that. So he's someone that we look up to as someone who was a very good person and someone to emulate. That if you could do all of those four things Muhammad said, then after that, he said, if you could do all four of these things, then you're guaranteed paradise. So if you want paradise, he didn't say you should pray, you should do that. Actually, just visit the cemetery. Why visit the cemetery? Because that reminds you of your mortality and how you need to get ready for that and make sure you do enough good on this earth before you leave. Feed the poor, because when was the last time we did something for someone else? We have to think about that. When was the last time we did something for someone else? Visit the sick. It's along the same lines to show that community. And fasting is for one's own discipline and nourishment. That was an interesting thing I was reminded of.
Well, and in the Lutheran tradition, Luther said that baptism, remembering your baptism daily, is to experience death as if it is near. Right? And so it is to feel, it is to sense that, remember that we are mortal. And at the very same time, beloved. Not yucky, not throwaways, but we are beautiful and beloved, precisely including our mortality.
There was a man who suffered from depression after he lost his farm. And so the doctors were giving him medicine, and it wasn't helping him, because the thing about antidepressants is you become tolerant to them, and then you need more and more and more. And so one of the doctors had the idea of giving this farmer a cow. And he gave him a cow, and his depression was cured. Because now he had something to do, and he reared this cow, and he got milk from it, and he got sustenance from it, and was able to feed his family from it. And so depression has, in modern day science, you have a medical cure for it, which is the certain chemicals within your brain. But that only cures the symptoms. It doesn't cure the underlying need that's there. And so for us to try to search for what that need is, whether it's spiritual or whether it's physical, is important as well.
So anything else anybody wants to say? Okay, so I want you all to get into groups of threes and see if you can form a question together, kind of share like how it felt, what you heard, and then kind of form a question. As best you can, and then we'll have a competition at the end for whose question was the best. is that true? No, we're not going to do that. There's no competition. So form groups of threes. Just for you got about 3 or 4 minutes. That's all you got.
The main answer to the question of what gives life meaning that we came up with was to leave the world a better place when we're gone, because we were here through our life, through our actions and work. And so the question is, how best, or how in terms of the three faith traditions, should we go about doing that? What is the way, the best way to leave the world a better place than we can?
Right now?
While we're alive,
right.
So when you look back at the end of life,
yes.
Did I have a meaningful life? And the meaning, and we said that at least one good definition of a meaningful life is that it left the world a better place for other people, because obviously now we're gone.
Well, so in response to sort of today, someone asked me last week a similar question, and my response was, they said, what's the purpose of religion today? And it was the context of American society. And so I would say for today, what one can do now that will leave our world a better place is to use the inspiration of our religious traditions to offset the negative impact of capitalism on our society, to temper the very negative forces that cause suffering based on the system that we all live in and participate in that has very horrible consequences for people. So whatever we can do in our own lives right now to help shift that system so future generations don't have to suffer because of the system we live in, that would be my response.
And so, going back to the individualism versus, being part of a larger collective, I think it's really important right now that we're wrestling with the impact of different types of racism. And we can use that as a model for how we understand how to leave the world a better place than we found, than we came into it. So we realize that racism is intrapersonal. It has to do with me and my attitudes toward myself as either being having power over others and being superior or being less than others. Racism happens interpersonally in the way I treat other people. It happens institutionally, how institutions are set up to advantage or disadvantage certain people, and how large systems, economic, political, even cultural, like larger narratives are told that advantage some and disadvantage others. And so I think all three faiths are trying to help us grapple with the reality of our personal agency and our personal blessedness, how we treat other people individually. But we also see in all three faith traditions an attempt to deal with the power of institutional and systemic evil. And my only concern about your beautiful phrase, right, within our Western individualist culture, is that we could say, well, as long as I was nice to my neighbor next door and, left that fence better than it was, so I think that Jesus, as a Christian, I see Jesus as leading me to work on all four areas every day, to work on my own sense of belovedness and to work on my character and help me become the person that God is creating me to be, to work on how I interrelate with other people, but also to be a leader in institutions and systems so that those systems are changed so that the world can continue to thrive. And so that would be my quick response to a beautiful statement.
So in my answer to this question, I guess there's two parts. The first part is the generic answer that you could be taken as universal, which is that every person is responsible to seek out the opportunities that are before them because everyone has their own context and their own situation. And only you know best what your context and your situation is and what opportunities you have before you to make the world a better place. So that's the generic response. And then the more specific response, I think, is I was reading a book on how it was a generic book on how churches, mosques, and synagogues can attract young people to their faiths and to their location. So one of the things she mentioned was that young people want to see their faith in action. They want to see that their faith has some kind of actual real life. It makes a difference somehow. And I was even just talking to Carol. Carol's right here. Mm-hmm. She's a part of the fan, and that's where I met her many months ago. And how 10, 20 years ago, a lot of times, a lot of their interfaith interactions were in study groups. But now it's at a protest in front of a courthouse or something like that. And that has a more powerful effect where other people are seeing this faith in action, and that faith is not something that is simply in our church or mosque or synagogue, but it's something that's out there in the world, and it's making an impact and it's making a difference. And so that's something I think we all need to try to find, is how can we put our faith into action, and how can we strengthen our minds here in these kinds of gatherings, but then also how can we act on these ideas outside once we return.
Next question.
Could we return to the previous slide to see the...
Sure. I'll try.
Thanks.
Just to clarify that The second question we're going to discuss tomorrow, and then Thursday we're going to discuss the third question.
Our group, well, we heard an active question, but we ended up talking about life and death, and especially the question, how does death figure into, you know, into you know, what gives life meaning? Is that?
Well, and also I'd say, what is amazing about death?
Yeah.
Why is death amazing? Yeah. Just like birth is amazing. I think death is equally amazing, not to be put off, not to be denied, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I'm of a school of thought that says that that empire, the energy that propels empire in the world or domination systems, are human beings unwilling to live in the tension between a desire to live and knowledge that we're going to die. An empire basically says, you don't have to think about dying because we'll be so busy feeling powerful over whoever those other people are that you'll feel so powerful all the time, you won't even have to think about it. And I believe all of our traditions are trying to say something very different, that life is beautiful and that our lives, we are limited and we're mortal. But we're beautiful and powerful and strong and incredible and wise and learning all at the same time, and that is beautiful and good, including our mortality and limitations. And so I believe, that Christianity moved a long ways away from that. About the 4th century when Rome took over Christianity. But it didn't completely get rid of it, because you could summarize like the creed to mean that if being human is good enough for God and Jesus, then being human is good enough for me and for us. So it wasn't lost completely, but it was lost at least in part. And I think empire wants to tell us, if you come along with me, you can win the game. You be a winner. You can have strategy. You can have power, and you don't have to think about being mortal, limited. And then, what does that do? Right? Yeah. At the end, it empties life of a lot of its meaning and our hearts of compassion, not only for our neighbors but for ourselves and for the God that loves us as we are. Like that would be the way I would see that. I think that we're right at the heart of the human experience with the question that you asked. And that just as we were given life as a gift, our life ends, and then we entrust ourselves to the one that made us and to the universe of which we're a part.
I have two responses. First is, it made me think about your
empire, domination.
And the scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where they find the Ark of the Covenant, the Nazis, and they open it up and they think that the Ark of the Covenant is going to be the key to eternal life, and then their faces melt off. And for a lot of Jewish kids, that's like their first introduction to the Holocaust, because they might see that movie at like 7, but we don't teach about it until much later. Like, who are those people and what are they doing with the Ark? But that sense of wanting the ultimate power, and then of course what you see what happens to them. I just always found that to be very moving. But the other response is about, you know, living in the shadow of death. You know, and I always have to remind myself that the Holocaust happened in a period of 6 years. 6 years or 8 years? A very short period of time, basically two American presidencies and 6 million Jews plus 4 million. Other people who were not considered desirables also were murdered, you know, and that's a lot of lost souls. And so what do you do when you have this heaviness of all these souls who were taken before their time riding along with you on your journey? And it's been our sort of primary prayer for mourning, which we say every single time we gather together, and we all rise for all those who have no one to say the mourner's prayer for them, because so many people were lost to unmarked graves. That whole prayer is an affirmation of life. And in part because we don't have a strong afterlife belief in Judaism. So imagine you have all these people die, and we don't really have an afterlife belief. So what do you do with that? You just develop a really strong this life belief about contributing to this world. And in Judaism, after people pass, we don't have an answer for what happens. Because Christians really ran with the afterlife concept. So Jews sort of, we just sort of dropped it as a theory. So it's completely this worldly focused. And so you do what you do here, and then you become sort of a part of the whole when you go. And your energy returns to the source. And so it's basically about understanding energy transfers from energy being in its confined form here to being in a more expansive form elsewhere. And thank you for that great question.
Wow.
I don't know how we are on time. I just heard the bell ring.
It's okay. We're okay. These people don't need to eat.
That's just the lunch bell. It's not the end of this.
Yeah.
We have 15 minutes at least.
Oh.
Okay. So, death. I mentioned a little bit in my talk about death being something that we prepare for in our faith. It's something that we acknowledge as being a reality of life. So in our faith, every prayer has a call to prayer, and the call to prayer for the funeral prayer is at birth. So the call to prayer is recited into the child's ears when he is born or she is born, and after they pass away, the prayer is prayed over the body. And so that kind of completes the cycle. And so death is something that Muhammad, peace be upon him, told us to remember, but not in order for us to be sad and grieving all the time, but in order for us to be ready for death and ready to meet God. And as Muslims, we do have a belief in the afterlife. We believe that after we die, we will be in our graves for a short period of time, after which there will be a day of judgment where we will be judged for our deeds. And we believe in the concept of heaven and hell. And we believe that our belief is not enough for us to enter heaven, but we have to also combine that with lots of good deeds. So that's what we believe.
Others?
What's your question? Oh, I'll go next. So I like how the two of you highlighted some of the differences there, because that's what I'm kind of interested in, because I think we all share the common belief and interest in caring for the planet, caring for the sick, helping the poor, doing good deeds. I mean, we all think that those are all valued parts of faith, but I guess other than negating for the other two non-Christian traditions, other than negating the divinity of Jesus, what aspects of his teaching are interpreted as incorrect by your faith? And then to the Lutheran pastor, what aspects of Jesus' teachings are missing from the other faiths? And so I like some of the afterlife part of it. I think I think for me it's quite obvious what we share, but I'm kind of interested in more of the differences.
Well, Judaism, I mean, as we practice it today, we're sort of done, not done, we continue to evolve, but a lot of its formation happened either alongside or before Jesus' followers were fully developed. So Judaism doesn't like have anything to say about Jesus. Like, Jesus isn't mentioned, we don't talk about Jesus, it's just not at all part of our framework, which I know is really, really hard sometimes for people to understand. I've tried to figure out a lot of different ways to explain it. But basically, like, so there's no critique because it's not a topic of conversation.
But as far as any conflicts with the teachings, is there like, this needs to be modified, but there's no conflict?
There's no conflict because we don't talk about it ever. Like, we just, it's just not, we don't talk about, we share a building with the church, and we're around Christianity, but it's just not, if we ever talk about Jesus, it's talking about how interesting the Second Temple period was, and all the different people who existed, and the rise of Christianity, and how that reflects on Judaism, the rise of Judaism as we know it. But we would never critique Christianity in that way. Like, it just wouldn't happen, which is interesting. There's nothing that we wouldn't say, like, there's nothing true, like, you're not true, this isn't true. We just wouldn't say anything.
Okay.
Well, Islam came after Christianity, so we do have a few things to say. What Pastor Terry and I talk about a lot is there are so many similarities between our faiths, the pursuit of truth and justice and helping others and helping the poor and helping the sick and so on, that we try to focus as much as we can on those similarities, because I think most people don't realize how much commonality there is. And a lot of times when people think of Islam, they think of this kind of Middle Eastern thing that's really strange and foreign. But Christianity also started in the Middle East, right? So that's something to think about. And we share a whole lot of stories. We share stories of Joseph and Noah and Jacob and Abraham, especially, and Ishmael and Isaac. I had a whole bunch of names listed out on my presentation yesterday. Adam and Eve, that story. But the one kind of, since you asked the question, I'll clarify the one. I think it's important to acknowledge the differences. We won't say everyone's the same. I think it's important to acknowledge our differences as well, and that helps us to, it helps us to engage in these kinds of things because we can acknowledge the differences. And so, so Islam does not believe that Jesus was divine, although we do honor him as a prophet of God, and his mother as the best woman to be on earth. And there's a chapter in the Quran named after Mary. In Arabic, she's known as Maryam. So a lot of Muslim women, you'll see their names as Maryam, which is Mary in English. And there isn't a chapter named after Jesus. There isn't a chapter named after Moses. Out of all of the prophets, Moses is mentioned the most in the Quran. Muhammad is only mentioned 4 times. Jesus is mentioned 25 times. Abraham is mentioned about 87 times. And Moses is mentioned, I think, over 100 times. So there's a reason for that, but I don't want to delve into that just because of time. And the other thing that I can remember right now is the idea of original sin. Muslims don't believe in the idea of original sin. We believe in the idea that people are born free of sin, and then after they reach puberty, then they become responsible for their deeds and responsible for their actions. That's the two things. But there's so many other small little details and stories and things like that, but this doesn't, it's not really worth it to get into those things.
Yeah, I think I'm also aware that the, you know, that for instance, you know, Johanna, you know, Jewish folk would not consider Jesus to be the Messiah, right? You know, I mean, obviously, you know, and also the Islamic tradition has a pretty strong critique of Trinitarian theology, which of course a lot of Christians also have a critique of Trinitarian theologies, namely that we don't always understand what it's trying to say. Right? You know, that's just true for lots of people. So there are real differences. What's been really fascinating, as I've gotten to know more communities and more people, is that folk are able to take different meaning systems and make the same mistake with them. I'm serious. So I have met a person who thinks that, I've met a Muslim man who thinks that that Christianity and Judaism are more primitive forms of spirituality and religion, and that and he encouraged me to convert. I also met a Baha'i that told me to do that. And I've met Christians that clearly feel that anybody who's part of a different tradition needs to convert right now, because otherwise they're going to get a big comeuppance, you know, when they die. I've met people who have placed so much emphasis on getting to the good place when you die that they really don't care much about what happens here in different traditions, not so much amongst Jews, right, but more amongst Muslims and Christians. And so I remember Douglas John Hall, my favorite theologian, saying that God permits theology. But the implication is that God only permits it a little bit, like reluctantly permits it, right? Because it's easy for us to self-justify our pattern of behavior and our larger culture. And so I think that what I've become more aware of is that, yes, there are real differences. The other reality is that people are people. And we all find a way to make some of the same mistakes, disconnecting from our neighbor and not caring about the earth and all the systems and the complexity, and withdrawing in passivity, either because of despair or because of some kind of passive optimism that the world is getting better and better mechanically on its own. And I have seen examples of that, of many of those, in every community I've been part of. So the theological differences are there. They're real. But each tradition, as Douglas John Hall says, has weak spots where human beings can misappropriate, misunderstand, misinterpret, and use the tradition to justify otherwise reprehensible or short-sighted behavior. And I've seen that in all of them, and I certainly have seen it amongst Christians. And I've heard Muslims and Jewish leaders both make the same laments about the tendency of people to misunderstand things. So the differences are there, but human beings are the same. And I would just like to say, the one thing I would say, Adam, about original sin is that many people have what we would call a street version of original sin, which is that human beings are made kind of bad. And that is, in fact, not, I think, what was being taught. It's not what Augustine was trying to say. I think what original sin is trying to say is that because of our limitation in mortality and the beauty of our creation at the same time, that human beings are vulnerable to certain kinds of mistakes, vulnerable in certain ways. And I think that's the way, like, Christian theology has been understanding original sin more lately. Because when you propose that human beings are totally depraved, then you are really saying that you need an authoritarian government or an authoritarian religion to control them, those nasty little buggers. And I have personally heard Lutheran pastors speak of the total depravity of the human being, which is not in Luther's thought, as I understand it, as an excuse for their poor behavior toward their parishioners, including sexual misconduct. So you know, we have a critique in the church of the concept of original sin as well, that it can be really, So anyway, yes, ma'am.
But what about the concept or the idea of, instead of original sin, original blessing?
And then we're created in the image of God. I mean, you didn't say that. I mean, that's part of our scriptural tradition. So I mean, so right in the beginning, where we have that. That's part of our heritage as well.
Right, and so just to make the same theological point the other way, it would be possible for someone who is intent on hurting other people to say, "Well, I was made in original blessing, and so therefore I'm not critiquable because whatever I do is okay." You see what I mean?
I hear what you're saying, but I don't think that people who subscribe to original blessing would come down in that way.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that human beings can sometimes use any language in ways that is not as deep as it might be. Yes, up there.
Yeah, so you actually were sort of touching on the subject of conversion. So one of the things that we were wrestling with is this is sort of a pre-question, is there a way to participate without joining in a way? Okay, so we're sort of tearing a page out of Anthony's discussion of Aquinas. Aquinas seemed to borrow things from a variety of sources, and then he ends up kind of codifying a lot of ways we think about Christianity. So our question is it possible to align yourself with one faith and borrow from others to learn to live in the world and still be true to God?
Wow, that was awesome. Yes.
You win.
That was great.
Well, I mean, I would say in the liberal Jewish tradition, the answer is a yes, that we do borrow from others, and we know that others borrow from us, and that that's part of being in America, I think, is that we have that freedom to learn and borrow and to be together, and we share a building with the church, so we have, they put on the door of the building when they built it some Jewish symbols so that we would feel more comfortable within there. So sharing a space means that we can share a common goal for creating sacred space in our society. It's interesting because in Judaism, we're forbidden from proselytizing. We're not allowed to try to encourage people to become Jewish. And as I was sharing yesterday with some people, that if someone wants to convert, you're technically supposed to send them away 3 times and just actively discourage them from converting. So that's, you know, that's, it's a completely different approach to to religion. And when someone does convert to Judaism, they take on the name, I'm Yohana, daughter of Abraham and Sarah. They actually are, the idea is that they've been adopted by Abraham and Sarah to join this, mm-hmm. this path, and they become their parents.
Yes, so there are people, for example, I'll just give the example of my mosque who have been coming to some of our Friday night services. Greg, he's been coming for 4 years. So it is possible, and there are people who do that. There's not too many of them, but Greg's welcome, and so is anyone else to attend our services and to be a part of that. And I think I can also think of another example of where we take from others. Because I work with youth, a lot of young people nowadays, they have questions about atheism and so on. And Christian authors have done a lot of work in that regard. So a lot of arguments I'll borrow from Christian authors that have done a lot of good work, and Muslim authors as well. So just to kind of show, because it's more of an argument for God versus the no argument for God and so on. So
this is actually a lot of the topic for the second class, so thank you for that wonderful plug. I'll just put this up here, if I can get it up here to work. Please work. Come on, Betsy.
Yeah.
There we go. What do you know? Oh, that's not it. Sorry. So our next session will be tomorrow from 4 to 5:30, and we'll cover a lot of this. So the great theologian Paul Tillich said that we worship the God beyond our idea of God. And I like to frame a lot of my work in partnership with people of other faith traditions under that rubric. So I think there are a lot of Christians, there are some Christians and some Christianities, because there's kind of more than one, that claim to understand God in some ultimate sense. And that is, of course, problematic, because that would be called idolatry, claiming to have control of God. So I prefer to recognize that whatever God is bigger than I can conceive, is bigger than my tradition can conceive, but I trust my tradition to point me toward it. And I also trust my tradition to allow me to question when it's falling short of it, and it always will. And so when I hear Yohana and Adam speak out of their deep tradition and their own growth as a human being, I am honoring the fact that they are also pointing to worshiping the God beyond our, you know, their idea of God. And then that lets us relax a little bit, because we're not in a competition, we're not playing rock'em sock'em robot, you know, with religious, to see who's going to be the religious winner. And we will be covering more of that, as I said, but that's a brief response. So thank you all very much for coming. We hope to see you again.